morning. I think we'll go ahead and get started. My name is Fred Niedner from Valparaiso, Indiana, where I teach in a department of theology, and I'm doing a series on God's promises finding their yes in Jesus Christ. And we've been doing a series of the major promises in the Hebrew Bible and seeing how Christianity understands those great promises of God to be fulfilled. And it doesn't always look like it seems to have been expected to look, or in some cases most certainly was expected to look. In the most ancient times, those promises were given to the people of Israel, and that is definitely the case with these three that we're in the middle of right now. The land yesterday, today the king, and on Monday the temple. The three great covenant symbols of God's faithfulness are given to Israel as eternal covenants, things they can count on forever as signs of God's chosen, or God's election of Israel as the chosen people. So today it's the king, and we'll see how this demonstrates that the more things change, the more they stay the same. And while we don't have kings in our culture anymore, as a public people, long for the same things the ancients did, but as Christians, we have a whole different understanding of what we really need. For alleged hilarity, I'm into random choices by this point. And I threw something into my files thinking I might be able to use it as a cartoon. Again, it's such a simple cartoon, I can describe it, you don't have to see it. It's simply a lawyer sitting at his desk on the telephone, surrounded by all his books and certificates and everything, and he's saying, "Act of God? Not a problem. We sue God." So there are people more powerful than kings in the world.
I think they are.
Yeah. By the way, have you ever heard that there are really only three actual lawyer jokes in the circulation? The rest are all true stories. Well, the really big promise that God would put a king from the line of David on the throne in Jerusalem forever. And even if the king or the people messed up, God might chastise the king, but never remove the Davidic line from the throne. It appears in 2 Samuel 7. We're going to look at that eventually, but there's a setup for that, a background, which is kind of fun to look at. It doesn't have a great deal to do with the way this promise becomes fulfilled, as we say in the Christian scriptures and in our tradition, but it certainly is enlightening about human beings. The story begins with the Israelites organized in tribes, like every other ancient people. In the period after they come out of the wilderness and take the promised land, as we talked about yesterday. And for 200 years, about as long as the history of the United States to this point, the Israelite tribes lived in what sometimes is called the tribal confederation, not in a technical sense of confederacy, but a loosely knit group of tribes that were all ethnically related but had their own internal leadership and so forth. And according to the book of Joshua, they gathered once a year and swore allegiance to Yahweh as their God. But they basically lived like tribes always live, mostly for themselves, and they didn't like each other as, you know, the Benjaminites and the Ephraimites might not have liked each other any more than they liked the Moabites or whatever, which becomes evident. good end, when a particularly awful thing happens, toward the end of the book of Judges, there is a horrible story about which many people have written, most significantly perhaps Phyllis Trible in her book Texts of Terror, when she writes about the Levite's concubine, this awful story of the man who's traveling with this concubine, a kind of wife, because she has left him and he's gone back to where she went, to her family's home, to convince her to come back with him. And on their way back to their home, they stay as guests in a town, and one of these terrible things happen where everybody wants to get at him, and he throws her out into this mob of people, this craven mob, which proceeds to rape and abuse her all night long and leave her dead on the doorstep. And in the morning he opens the door and there she is, lying dead on the doorstep, only he doesn't know she's dead until he says, "Okay, time to get up, let's go," and she doesn't move. Whereupon, in outrage that someone has killed his concubine, as though he had nothing to do with it, he cuts her body into 12 pieces and dispatches a piece to each of the 12 tribes of Israel, and with a message attached saying, "Look what they did, look what the Benjaminites did to my concubine. Let's get vengeance on the Benjaminites." And so a war starts that nearly wipes out the tribe of Benjamin and creates all kinds of problems, such that they have to go looking for, borrowing population from other tribes in order to repopulate the tribe of Benjamin, sort of like we do with the protected species. They thought they should preserve the tribe of Benjamin and so forth. But, you know, there's this awful story at the end of the book of Judges, the story of their life under the tribal confederacy. And the last line of the book of Judges is, "When there was no king in Israel, everyone did what was right in his own eyes." That's the judgment upon that period, finally, by the narrator, whom scholars call the Deuteronomistic history. The Deuteronomistic history is the books of Joshua, Judges, 1 and 2 Samuel, and 1 and 2 Kings. The books that tell the story of Israel's life in the land, from the time they entered it to the time they lost it at the end of 2 Kings. So that period showed them that they needed something better than just life as tribes. So their solution was, let's have a king. Or at least that was the idea of some people. And they go to Samuel the prophet in 1 Samuel 8. And this is the point at which I'd like us to start this morning. If you've got a Bible and you want to follow along, 1 Samuel 8 is where we'll look. And this is just fascinating and kind of fun. It's not directly apropos necessarily to the outcome of this whole thing. But anyway, when Samuel became old, Samuel was the last of the judges. He will also be the kingmaker, as it turns out. He's kind of a cross between a prophet and a judge. He made his sons judges over Israel. The name of the first was Joel. The name of the second, Abijah. They judged in Beersheba. But his sons did not follow in his ways. They turned aside after Dan. They took bribes and perverted justice. So they weren't chips off the old block. They were crooks. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, "You're old and your sons are crooks. Appoint us a king to govern us like the other nations." Now, if you're reading this in Hebrew and you know the Yiddish, you already know there's obscenity in the air, because they go to Samuel and say, "Give us some assistance here. We want to be like the Goyim." Because the word for the nations, "We want to be like the nations," is goyim in Hebrew. So this is already, "We want to be like the other people." But this thing displeased Samuel when they said, give us a king to govern us. So Samuel prayed to the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, listen to the voice of the people in all they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. So God takes this as a personal insult. I'm their king. What do you mean they want a king? It's not you they're criticizing, it's me. Just as they've done to me from the day I brought them up out of Egypt to this day, forsaking me and serving other gods, now they're going to do the same thing to you, Samuel. What are you going to do? But listen to their voice. Only solemnly warn them and show them the ways of the king who will reign over them. So Samuel reported all the words of the Lord to the people who were asking for a king. He said, this or these will be the ways of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them to his chariots and to be his horsemen and to run before his chariots. He'll appoint for himself commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties. So the first thing you'll get if you get a king is the military draft. He'll register all your sons, take them in to the army, and everybody's going to be in the king's army. But also some to plow his ground and to reap his harvest and to make his implements of war and the equipment of his chariots. The military-industrial complex. You know, the army, the civil service, and all the industry that it takes to make the implements of war. And it won't just be the men. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers because kings need to live nice. We've got to support the king in a wonderful lifestyle. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive orchards and give them to his courtiers. Take a tenth of your grain and your vineyards. Give to his officers. You know what that is? That's the IRS. Taxation. It takes money to support the military-industrial complex and this fine lifestyle. He'll take your male and female slaves and the best of your cattle and donkeys and put them to his work, a tenth of your flocks, and you will become his slaves. And in that day you will cry out because of your king, whom you chose for yourselves. And the Lord isn't going to answer you in that day. So go ahead and get a king, God says. Go ahead and pick a king. You will hate it. I promise you, you will hate it. It's a terrible idea. And you will rue the day that you made this choice, but go ahead and do it because you aren't going to listen to me. But when you get sick of it, don't come around here complaining. Because I don't want to hear it. So, the dilemma of human beings over government, central government. We want government, but we hate it. Pretty soon we're all belly up about the government. The government this and the government that. Does this sound familiar?
The origins of the Tea Party.
Pardon me?
The origins of the Tea Party.
Yeah. Well, so the people refused to listen to the voice of Samuel and they said, no, we are determined to have a king over us so that we can be like the other nations, that our king may govern us and go out before us and fight our battles. And when Samuel heard the words of the Lord, he repeated them into the ears of the Lord. I always love that. And the Lord said, listen to their voice. Give them a king. So Samuel said to everybody, go back home. And then he develops a plan, which I'll talk about in a moment. By the way, there was more reason than just their own infighting to want a king. The Philistines were always whomping up on them. If you know the book of Judges, you know that countless times other people who had technological superiority to the Israelites were oppressing them. Israel was one of the last of the civilizations into the Iron Age because they didn't do any seafaring kind of trade, and the Philistines who did had harder metals for their tools and agricultural and military devices than the Israelites. So it was easy to pick on the Israelites. You know, chariot tech- technology takes a certain kind of metal, and the Israelites just didn't have it. And they weren't going to get it until, you know, Solomon really got them into the technological age they needed to be in order to fully protect themselves. But as we'll eventually see, it took Solomon enslaving almost a third of his population in forced labor camps down in the copper mines of Ezion Geber, far to the south, and the smelting operations that it took to make the kinds of things that they really needed to have in order to compete with the Philistines and others. So they did need a government, but God says they'll hate it. Well, so how do you get a king? There was no precedent in Israel, so much of the rest of the story here for many chapters becomes the story of how the monarchy developed. You know, once the monarchy was developed, it lasted, this is right around 1040 BCE, when they go to Samuel, and the monarchy is going to last in one form or another all the way until 586, when the Babylonians destroyed Jerusalem. The northern kingdom would lose their part, as we'll see in 722, but it lasted for hundreds of years, a half a millennium. Almost. And so a bunch of chapters talk about how it develops. But how do you get a king when you've never had one? Well, Samuel didn't know. And God didn't, like, you know, drop a garland around someone's shoulders or something and say, ta-da, this is the one, or a dove didn't light on his head. So what did Samuel do? I mean, it's a funny story. It's delightful. It's good reading for kids, and I'm sure that was part of the point of it. Samuel went around looking at people thinking, does that look like a king? And one day he saw this guy, young fellow, handsomest dude he'd ever laid eyes on, head and shoulders taller than anybody else in the whole community, said, now that looks like a king. So he started following this guy around. Turns out to be this young fellow named Saul. But now how do you spring this on somebody and say, you are going to be the king? So he starts following this guy around until he can get him sort of by himself one day. And sort of like that book I was telling you, some of you, about earlier this morning, how do you announce somebody's death, you know, when you're trying to do it in private. But anyway, Samuel follows Saul around. One day Saul is sent out by his father to find some lost donkeys. So he's off wandering around in the middle of nowhere looking for lost donkeys. And Samuel, I don't know what he does, leaps out from behind a rock and says, I gotta talk to you. You're going to be the king. And Saul says, what? And so they talk about this, and Samuel says, I'm gonna anoint you the king, but you can't tell anybody. When you go back home, you gotta keep this to yourself, at least till I let you know. So, you know, Saul finally goes home, and his father says, well, did you find the lost donkeys? No, but I got a secret. So this whole funny thing happens. But finally, Saul is made the king. And, you know, most of you are familiar, I suppose, with the story of how Saul tried to unite the Israelite tribes into a coherent people. And he met with a lot of resistance. There were all sorts of people around who gave him difficulty, besides the Philistines and others who were always causing them trouble. And one of the people who gave him the worst difficulty was this crazy guy who was a friend of his son's named David. Sort of a little hero guy from down in the south, the southern tribes down there. This fellow, he was clever. Was a friend of Jonathan, and he even acted friendly towards the king, but behind the scenes he was always doing things that made things difficult. Among other things, he worked for the Philistines. He hired himself out as a mercenary to the Philistines and learned military tactics and so forth. But then he comes back and he starts building a little support base for himself behind the scenes. And along the way, Saul has this little episode in which he loses God's favor, and Samuel anoints David to be the next king. Saul is eventually destroyed in a battle with the Philistines, and David then becomes the next king. So Saul is a transitional figure, and David becomes the next king. And there's a whole lot more to this story about exactly how David became king, and the way that he used all sorts of clever political tricks to solidify power. He chose a capital different from the one in which Saul had ruled, which was a neutral city, Jerusalem, and he found ways to consolidate power and get rid of rivals that Saul could never quite pull off. The next development then is 2 Samuel 7, when all of David's battles for becoming king have been successful. He is at rest in his palace, and Nathan, the prophet, comes to him and says, see now, chapter 7, verse 2, David says to the prophet Nathan, I'm living in a house of cedar, but the ark of God is living in a tent. By the way, bringing the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem was one of the key moves. Bringing the religious symbols from elsewhere to be in Jerusalem so that everybody's got to come to Jerusalem, his capital, in order to be in touch with the holy things. So Nathan said to the king, go do all that you have in mind, for the Lord is with you. But that night the word of the Lord came to Nathan, go and tell my servant David this, are you the one to build me a house to live in? I have not lived in a house since the day I brought up the people of Israel from Egypt to this day. I've been moving around in a tent and a tabernacle. Wherever I moved about among the people of Israel, did I ever speak a word with any of the tribal leaders of Israel whom I commanded to shepherd my people, saying, why haven't you built me a house? I don't care about houses. Now this, we're going to have to remember this Monday for those of you who are still here. This is the same comment about temple as we saw earlier about kings. God hated the whole idea of kings. God hated the whole idea of temple. What's with the temple? I'm not a temple God. You can't put me in a box. I'm a traveling God, man. I go around in tents. I'm free. So say to my servant David, thus says the Lord of hosts, I took you from the pasture, from following the sheep, to be prince over my people. I've been with you wherever you went. Cut off your enemies before you. I'll make for you a great name, like the name of the great ones of the earth, and appoint a place for my people Israel, and plant them so they can live in their own place, be disturbed no more, and evildoers shall afflict them no more as formerly from the time I appointed judges over the people. Moreover, the Lord declares to you that the Lord will make for you a house. Excuse me, make you a house, not for you. And here house means something different. Here house means dynasty. It's got a double meaning in Hebrew. When your days are fulfilled and you lie down with your ancestors, I will raise up your offspring after you who shall come forth from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. So God's going to concede and agree to a temple, although it's not God's first choice. But now get this. I will be a father to him, and he shall be a son to me. When he commits iniquity, I will punish him with a rod like mortals use, with blows inflicted by human beings. But I will not take my steadfast love from him, and the word there is my covenant faithfulness. Hesed is the word for steadfast love, covenant faithfulness, as I took it from Saul, who I put away from before you. Your house and your kingdom shall be made sure forever before me. Your throne shall be established forever. In accordance with all these words and with all this vision, Nathan spoke to David. You can't be more clear than that about what this promise is. An eternal dynasty. such a crisis, because this is a deep, deep piece of the tradition, that God promised this. And there's no codicil here that says, oh, and by the way, if the king does certain things, I'm going to do away with this whole deal. No. There are threats like that about a few other things, but not about this. That's why this was such a terrific crisis when finally there was no more Davidic king. I love to point out when I'm teaching this to my students that we have some huge pieces of Christian tradition with their origins at this point. I mean, for one thing, the way you get a king, what the prophet always did was, you get prophets anoint king, so the anointed one, in Hebrew, of course, and most of you know this, is that word, Messiah. That's where that word comes from. And now, did you hear God says, here's how much I love this king deal. The king's going to be my son, and I'm going to be his father. So the king is the Messiah, or Christ in Greek, and Son of God. So that's where this language starts. To be the Christ and the Son of God, originally, is the king. That's where that language begins. And the role of the king is to be the gatherer, the defender, protector, and provider of the people, the chosen people, God's elect. That's what a Messiah is. And a Messiah is also the Son of God. So to make a long story short, we keep this going for half a millennium. There are some very interesting things we could take a look at, such as the split of Solomon's kingdom, because he was, you know, so oppressive of getting the people into the age they had to be, you know, and they finally did not want to do one more round of strategic planning, and they seceded. The northerners did, and then you had a split kingdom, but still down in the south they had the sons of David on the throne for all those centuries. And then we get to the failure of all this, and if you want to look at it quickly in the text, it's in 2 Kings 23. Well, actually, we should maybe start back to now, chapter 21, very quickly. The last few kings are a very interesting bunch down there in Jerusalem, beginning with this king named Manasseh in the beginning of 2 Kings 21. It says he was 12 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 55 years in Jerusalem. And he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, following the abominable practices of the nations. If we had time, I could show you that abominable practices of the nations included some things we would take for granted, like making treaties with foreign nations, which the prophets and the Deuteronomistic historian would always reject, because it involved allowing the practice of other religions in your territory. And that then is what led to all the trouble for which Manasseh is famous. And Manasseh is accused here of having tried to wipe out the religion of Yahweh. And he is said to have slaughtered his own children in child sacrifice and done all kinds of things like that. And he ruled for 55 years in a very dangerous time. So he was a successful king. But he almost, you know, 55 years in a time when the life expectancy was 35. Means by the time Manasseh died, hardly anybody could remember what it used to be like when the worship of Yahweh was the default position. Now it was like California. I'm just kidding. No, I can because I'm not. Anyway, so then Manasseh dies, and there's a son of his takes the throne, and he is very quickly assassinated. And then we have on the throne a young fellow named Josiah, chapter 22, who was 8 years old when he began to reign. And I guarantee you that 8-year-olds do not sit around thinking about the gross domestic product and all that kind of stuff. They're playing Nintendo while the guys who put them on the throne are making plans. And what the people who put Josiah on the throne do was conduct a total reform and take Israel in one fell swoop straight back to the worship of Yahweh. They do their own violence. They kill all the people who resist this. And they reestablish an old-fashioned, pure version of Yahweh worship, and they try to undo everything that Manasseh had done, and they pull it off. They have a complete reform. In the process, they find a book in the temple that tells them what to do, and if you look at this book very carefully, or what this book supposedly says, can tell it's part of the book of Deuteronomy as we know it, and but nobody had ever seen it before. And so they reform the whole nation on the basis of that document. And then 2 Kings 23, after talking about all the things that that Josiah pulled off, in verse 24 we read, "Moreover, Josiah put away all the mediums, wizards, teraphim, idols, and all the abominations that were seen in the land of Judah and Jerusalem, so he established the word of the Lord," and so forth. Verse 25, "Before him there was no king like him who turned to the Lord with all his heart and all his soul and all his might, according to all the law of Moses, nor did any like him arise after him." So this was the greatest, most faithful king ever. I mean, what a statement to say. There was never a more faithful king before or after. But still the Lord did not turn from the fierceness of his great wrath, by which his anger was kindled against Judah because of all the provocations with which Manasseh had provoked him. So the Lord said, "I'll remove Judah also out of my sight like I did Israel, and reject the city that I have chosen, and the house of which I said, my name shall be there." And the next thing we read is that Josiah goes up against Pharaoh Necho and gets himself killed. And within 20 years, the whole thing was over. What in the world? Josiah did exactly what the book of Deuteronomy said. And the book of Deuteronomy says, if you obey the Lord, you are safe. Nothing can happen to you. Besides that, they had the eternal promise of the king. From 2 Samuel 7. And Josiah obeyed perfectly, but God said, "Well, that's pretty good, Josiah. But you know, I can't forget about Manasseh, so the hell with all of you." Do you like that theology? You can be as faithful as you want. You can return to the Lord with all your heart, soul, and mind, and reform an entire generation. But if God has a grudge against your grandpa, forget it.
Isn't that what the fourth commandment says? Under the fourth generation?
Yeah, God is said to have talked that way, I hold grudges. God talks out of both sides of God's mouth, the way the scriptures work. You know? God also says, "I'm gracious and merciful, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love, and repent of the things that I say I'm going to do." Or not. So if you take the whole Bible, you got massive confusion. But what's really going on here is this narrator, near the end of the Deuteronomistic history, is trying to figure out, how could this happen? How could it possibly be that we have this promise of God, that God would keep a king on the throne forever? What could possibly have happened? And the only thing this narrator can figure is, whatever Manasseh did must have been so bad that there was no reform in the world that could finally bring us back from the slide that started us on. Even poor Josiah, faithful as he was, can't stop God from finally giving up on this king project. Well, basically what we have here is divided opinion about kings. I mean, first of all, I didn't stop to ask you to ponder this, but what's with the switch from 1 Samuel 8 to 2 Samuel 7? In one generation, God says, this idea is awful. It's the worst thing I ever heard of. It's rebellion against me. And the next generation, God says, man, what a great idea. King, yeah, let's do it. Let's keep it going forever. I'll be your dad even. Is God schizophrenic? Or do we have two really very different traditions, both of which God saved? Anti-monarchy tradition and pro-monarchy tradition. And, you know, a half a millennium later, when the whole thing falls apart, who do we blame for the loss of everything? Well, it's ultimately the monarchy that takes the rap here in the Deuteronomistic history. That's who failed us, the kings. So in any case, we got to go quickly now to get to where the New Testament shows us the how Christ is the king. Israel would never again, or Jerusalem would never again, have a Davidic king on the throne in Jerusalem. Except, as we're going to see, that one on the outside of town who had this funny looking throne shaped like a cross, and above which it said, this is the king of the Jews. That's the only son of David who ever had anything remotely like a throne in Jerusalem again after 586. What happened? We don't have time to look at it. Babylonians came, put a 3-year siege to the city, and when they finally broke the siege, they took the current king, tied him up, slaughtered his entire family in front of him, and then gouged his eyes out, so that the last thing he ever saw was his entire family being slaughtered, hacked to death in front of him, and then he was led off blind into exile to live out the rest of his days with that vision of what he saw in his last moments of seeing. That was the way to put an end to kings. This is a crisis of major proportions. Can you trust God? God made a promise, and it's gone. There is no more king in Jerusalem. And it took all kinds of prophets to deal with this, just like it did with the loss of the land. The prophets Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Isaiah 40 to 55, all of them at some point during the exile talked about kings and monarchy, and there are texts scattered around elsewhere that seem to come from the exilic period where people longed for a king who could save them. There is the promise of a Messiah of a very different kind that some of you referred to the other day already. In Isaiah 45, that exilic prophet near the end of the exile announces to Israel that there's a new Messiah come to rescue you. It's Cyrus of Persia. Even though he does not know your name, I have called him by name. Or even though he does not know God's name, God says, I have called him by name. I have taken his right hand. He is the Lord's Mashiach, the Lord's Messiah, and he will let you out of here and take you back to your land. Israel didn't like that very much, a Gentile king, a Gentile Messiah. But that's the next Messiah on the scene, is a Gentile. There's critique of the monarchy, like in Ezekiel 34, if you want to flip to that for a second, there's a long, as they all are in Ezekiel, very redundant tirade against the shepherds. Ezekiel denounces the shepherds of Israel who have been feeding yourselves. Shouldn't shepherds feed the sheep? But you eat the fat. You clothe yourselves with the wool. You slaughter the fat ones. You don't feed the sheep. You haven't strengthened the weak. You haven't healed the sick. You haven't bound up the injured. You haven't brought back the strayed. You haven't sought the lost. But with force and harshness you have ruled. Shepherd language in the Bible is always political. It's king language. Ever since David, the shepherd boy, shepherd language is king language. Including the 23rd Psalm. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. What that's really about is the Lord is my king. I don't need these other kings. The Lord is my king. What Ezekiel's prophecy promises is, verse 8 and following, as I live, says the Lord, because my sheep have become a prey, food for wild animals and so forth, I'm against all those other shepherds, and I'm going to have to come myself and be the shepherd. Rescue the sheep from their mouths so that they may not be food for them. I myself will search for my sheep and seek them out, and so forth and so forth. Now, exactly how would God do that? How, what could Ezekiel have in mind? The institution of monarchy has failed. It's always self-serving. They never really seek the welfare of the sheep. They only enrich themselves. So I'll do it myself. What would that look like in flesh and blood terms? Theocracy? What would a theocracy look like? So it's hard to tell exactly what Ezekiel imagines with this prophecy. Because as we know, because of what we witness, theocracy is never any better than monarchy. I mean, look at Iran, where theocracy is partly the system. Look at the kind of theocracy that some people in the United States want to establish. Theocracy always means, we think we are right and everybody else is wrong. We know what God thinks, so we're going to be in charge. But then they always end up ruling like everybody else does. So what can Ezekiel possibly imagine? It's hard to tell. In any case, how does Christ become the yes to the promise that there will be a Davidic king on the throne in Jerusalem forever? Or how could Christ become the yes to a promise like the one that Ezekiel makes? Well, of course, we have this language. It all works for us. We know exactly, and I'll let it, remind us of it all over the next 13 minutes. How will Christ do this? How can Christ do what God promises and not have it just be the old way again? I always begin this conversation at Matthew 4 and Luke 4. The story of the temptation in the wilderness, where what's really going on is a test concerning what kind of Messiah Jesus will be. The tempter asks three questions. If you are the Son of God, why don't you work it this way? Rule as this kind of king. And the third one is the most blatantly political. Well, it's the third, depending upon which, whether you're in Matthew or Luke. But Satan says, the tempter says, hey, see all these kingdoms of the world? You can have it all. You can be the king. You can be the ruler. All you got to do is worship me. And you can have it. It's all yours. Well, what is going on? Long story short, the way I understand this is that the worship of Satan isn't like some little quick ritual bow, say, okay, I'll bow to you, I know you won't tell, I won't tell, and we'll have this little exchange here and then you can have it. No, worship is to admit and live by the admission that your way of doing things is the only way that works. So what Satan really wants is admit that my way of having the nations and controlling the nations of the world is the only way that works, and you can have it. Well, what is Satan's way of ruling the world? At the time, the great Satan, in, at least from a Christian perspective, was Rome, and is called such in the book of Revelation. The Roman Empire is the great Satan, the great whore Babylon. And Rome controls the world. And how does Rome control the world? How does the great Satan control the world? The way every empire that has ever ruled the world rules the world, namely by intimidation, by threat, by force. You do things our way, or we kill you. Take your pick. What do you want? Yes, we'll build you roads. Yes, we'll build you aqueducts. Yes, we'll have a standard coinage system. Yes, we'll have a common language. Yes, we're going to have benefits up the wazoo. But you will do things our way, or we kill you. What do you choose? That's how Satan reigns. That's why Rome is the great Satan. So Jesus, all you got to do is admit that that's the only way to keep control in the world, is by means of force. You can have it. And Jesus says, no. Won't do that. And claims that God has another way. You shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve. Now, what is God's way if it's not intimidation and force? Well, you could go back to the old book and find all kinds of ways in which God acts, like force and power and killing, by the way, to get control, right? We were there yesterday for a while. But as we all know, in Christian theology, where Jesus goes, the throne he finally takes is the cross. And he explains what kind of king he will be in the manner of Ezekiel at points along the way, like, for example, John 10, the Good Shepherd chapter. That's all politics, friends. That's not pastoral theology. That's politics. I am the Good Shepherd, he says. All the other shepherds are robbers and crooks and thieves. You know why? Because they're out for their own gain. I am different. I lay down my life for the sheep. If you read John 10 against Ezekiel 34, what you see is that Jesus is describing himself as the exact kind of shepherd that God promises in Ezekiel 34, one whose goal is not the enrichment of himself, but one who so loves the sheep that he will give up life, he will give up self for the sake of the sheep. The whole way of being king conventionally is the people have to be sacrificed for the sake of the king. When push comes to shove, we have to save the king, because that's what endures, is the king. The people are expendable. It's exactly the opposite in the theology of Ezekiel's shepherd. When God comes to be shepherd, it's the other way around. And that's what Jesus lives out. And of course, that's what we see in all the royal theology that comes in the passion narratives of the Gospels, like John's, in which Jesus tells Pontius Pilate, who asks him, "Are you a king?" And Jesus says to Pilate, "You say that I'm a king," and it's very ambiguous grammar. It's actually a kind of a imperative statement to Pilate. Yes, now Pilate, this is your job. You say that I'm a king, and Pilate goes ahead and does it. Pilate goes through the whole process of declaring Jesus the new king, cleverly weaving in the words at one point that Samuel said of Saul, when Saul presented, when Samuel presented Saul to Israel as the new king, he says to them, "Behold the man." Does that sound familiar? I mean, it's borrowed. I mean, parts of John is borrowed straight out of Second Samuel there, First Samuel, excuse me. And so Jesus becomes the king. Only he becomes the king that gives his life for the sheep, for the flock, for the people. My favorite scene for depicting this, although I love John's, is Luke 23. Verses 38 and following, there we see Jesus being king. Luke 24, 2-3, but verses 38 and following. Well, start at 36. The soldiers mocked Jesus coming up and offering them sour wine and saying, "Hey, if you're the king of the Jews, save yourself." There was an inscription over him, "This is the king of the Jews." So here you see, Jesus is declared the king, just like in the other Gospels. One of the criminals who were hanged there kept deriding him, saying, "Aren't you the Messiah? Save yourself." But the other rebuked him, saying, "Don't you fear God? Aren't you under the same sentence of condemnation? And we indeed have been condemned justly. We're getting what we deserve." This man hadn't done anything wrong. And all through Luke's gospel, the question is whether Jesus is innocent. And so here's one more witness to Jesus' innocence. But there's more going on here. Then he says, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom," which is a line out of the Joseph story. When Joseph is going to get out of prison, and those two guys, the baker and the butler, ask him, "Remember me when you get out." You know, it's that kind of talk. Jesus replied, "Truly, I tell you, today you'll be with me in paradise." Now, this is, I love to tell my students, you have to understand comedy in order to really get this scene. You have to understand there's a joke going on here. That, for one thing, crucifixion, the whole point of crucifixion was to make a horrible joke of someone, to strip someone naked and mutilate them and hang them up on a scaffold in front of God and everybody and abuse them and watch them die of all the things you could die of while hanging there. It was the most horrible way to kill anybody because of the shame of it as well as the gruesomeness of it. And the whole point was to make a mockery of some human being. And in the middle of that, here's two crucified guys making plans. And imagine the conversations later on that night among the soldiers and others who witnessed. Man, those crucified guys will just about say anything. Those two guys today making their plans, man, what was that all about? One guy says to the other, "Hey, you with the king thing over your head, can I be your left-hand or right-hand guy?" And the other guy says, "Sure, buddy, yeah, you and me today, let's do it, sure, this is it, doesn't get any better than this." You know, it's a joke, it's gallows humor, it's weird. But this is who we say we are, right? This is my favorite picture of the church, I love to say. A bunch of crucified people hanging around, you know, crucified with Christ by baptism into his death, saying, "Now what? What do we do next?" That's our kingdom, and that's our king. The crucified king. The king who gives his life for the flock, and we, the fellow crucified. This is our way of ruling in the world as that one's left and right hand lieutenants. So that's how Jesus becomes the yes to the promise, not only of David, that there will always be a king on the throne in Jerusalem, the son of David. And that's what it ultimately looks like, at least in Christian theology. it's also the yes to the promise that Ezekiel makes, that I will come and do it myself, and it won't be in the way, the self-serving way that other people do. So we've got a couple minutes to discuss this, if anybody's got questions or if that sounds... It's obviously oversimplified. That was another flying trip through ancient political theory and theology of the cross and everything in between.
I'd be curious to what's the Greek word for paradise? Or how did that
be? Paradise. It's a Persian word. It's a Persian word that means a walled garden. It's the word in Zoroastrianism for where you went if you passed the great test and were proved on the side of good and not evil. But it's just like the Christian tradition picked up, and so did Judaism, pick up things like Hades. Hades is the Greek underworld. It's where everybody goes, good, bad, and in between. That's, you just go to Hades is the underworld. But Hades sort of gradually becomes hell in Christian tradition, just like paradise, the Persian, borrowed from the Persians, becomes a way to talk about the alternative. But they get quite redefined. But that's what paradise. The original name, I mean, there was no other really word. Bosom of Abraham is another metaphor that gets used. The original word for the alternative, Hades, is Gehenna. You know what that is? The landfill outside Jerusalem. The dump. The point being, you have wasted your life. That's, you spend your life in the landfill. Spend eternity in the landfill because you had your chance, you wasted your life, that's it. But that's all metaphors used to talk about stuff we don't understand. Well, the bell rang. We need to go drink coffee or take care of the last cup of coffee. Thank you.